to 4 o'clock. All right? Same show, just a little bit longer format. Again, it's the Rhythmic Ride on the only station making waves, 89.3 WHFR, Dearborn.
Thematic. Heard on Wednesdays from 12 to 4. Thematic. Thematic. Music and themes and so much more. Sometimes things can get dramatic. And sometimes things can get rather silly. But one thing's for sure, Bill Mack will guide you through. And try to leave you feeling giddy. From 12 to 4, thematic, thematic, interviews, some classics, and so much more, thematic, 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 woo! Catch Thematic with Phil Mack every Wednesday from 12 to 4.
Hey, hey, this is the Gothabilly Man, your friendly neighborhood beatnik from the Wrecking Hours radio show, wishing you and yours happy holidays this season and many more to come.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College,
this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener supported.
Non-commercial radio.
Welcome to the WHFR Journal. As we are feeling the holiday spirit in so many ways, but some of us are feeling it, feeling the winter season and all the yuck that comes along with it, the colds and the congestion. But I'm so looking forward to being back on the air with you. One thing that I think most makes me feel just so happy when I'm frustrated or down or thinking of all the troubles in the world is when somebody sends me a little video of a little dog or a little kitty doing something so adorable. There's just something to be said about pets in our lives and the joy and the just the true stress relief that they provided. So we decided to dedicate a whole segment to that concept. So, of course, we went to the experts at Friends for Animals of Metro Detroit. So excited and happy here on the Journal today to have Corey Keller joining in, president and CEO of Friends for Animals of Metro Detroit. We have known them for years and years. If you've been in the community for a long time, it's the Dearborn Animal Shelter. I have the pleasure of getting to see you, Corey, as we're having this discussion. Our radio listeners can only imagine this debonair man petting the sweetest little kitty cat that I just saw on your screen. So welcome to you. And who was that little kitty?
Yeah, thanks, Susan, for having me. That is Gabe. She is probably 4 months now. I adopted her from our shelter, Friends for Animals in Metro Detroit. So she is a handful, let's just say that, but she's very sweet. So she's very curious.
Love it. We are curious to hear about all the things that are going on with your organization. And I am so enamored by the history and the legacy that this organization has had in our community and thinking always of sort of reinventing yourselves. And we know that this organization is changing lives, both the, you know, the four-legged ones as well as the those of us that are of the human breed. Tell us about your history, your legacy.
Of course. Yeah. So Friends for Animals has been around for just over 30 years now. So we celebrated our 30 years in August of this year. And it really started with a very small group of volunteers who saw a need in the community with stray animals in the city of Dearborn. And so from that direct result, kind of birthed this, you know, Dearborn Animal Shelter. And they got the city involved, and the city gifted them, you know, some property that was the city's, as well as a small building to be able to work out of. So, and so they've been, you know, taking in stray animals for decades now. You know, fast forward to today, where we have two locations actually. And, you know, one is our, what we would call our Greenfield location. So that's our old existing location that has that building on it, that small building that's decrepit now. It's falling apart. You know, the ceilings, leak, foundation is crumbling. And then we have our, newer facility, our Marianne Wright Animal Adoption Education Center, which is on Reckinger Road in Dearborn. It's right behind our police department. And so that was opened in 2018. And, you know, it was a way to kind of start, you know, reinventing ourselves a little bit, kind of getting up to speed with the times and the standards in animal welfare, and being able to provide a quality and caring environment for animals while they wait for their forever home. So that facility or that center now is 5 years old, if you can believe that. And, you know, we rescue and save and bring in over 2,500 animals a year. And majority of it being, you know, cats and dogs, you know, because it is animal control and we have a city contract. We sometimes will see, you know, livestock, goats, things of that nature, birds, some wildlife. But now we, you know, this year specifically, we broke ground again on the adoption center to expand it, because what we're trying to achieve here is merge our locations so that our staff, volunteers, and animals are all under the same roof.
It sounds like we could tackle the rest of this interview from any of those different facets that you've shared, Corey, because there's really, truly so much going on with this organization, and it really all does sort of come together in support of animals of all kinds based on what you've shared. As a community, giving, interested, you know, supportive community, what are some of, from your perspective to date, to these days, your biggest needs, aside from some of the sort of physical relocation issues and so on and so forth? And I remember some of those campaigns for fundraisers and so on. Some of them have been, you know, going on for many years, but it's so exciting to see the fruits of so many people's labor get, you know, turning corners and making things better and better. But what do you need now? What are some of the things that we can do as a community to support this organization, to support animals in general? And then we'll talk a little bit about sort of the holiday season as well, and the concept of do's and don'ts for your pets.
Sure, of course. So, you know, I think what we absolutely need right now is awareness. Awareness of our organization and the mission and vision that we're doing and the good work that we're doing out in the community. You know, whether it's, you know, if it's the time of year where you're ready for, bringing that furry little friend into your, and adding a family member to your home, you know, certainly now's the time. Any time of year truly is the time, but, you know, we are here not only as a facilitator of, finding you that furry animal, or being a resource or a location where you can come in and view the various animals up for adoption. But we're there all along the process. So, you know, our staff is trained in counseling. Let's find you the best fit so that we can make it a forever home and really give these animals a second chance. So, you know, all year long, you know, probably it really started, happening in July. Our shelter has been over capacity with animals. And so it's been very hard with the amount of space we have and the number of animals coming in. We've had to, you know, certainly, you know, be resourceful, move animals around, utilize our foster program. So that's another area of need. We're always looking to grow our foster network, because some animals just don't do well in a shelter. It's not a home. It can be a stressful environment. And some animals need to recover. We saw a lot of heartworm positive dogs this year, and they need a home to recover in versus in a shelter. We've also had a lot of neglect cases. And so again, fostering really helps save lives because they can rest and recover in a home while we prepare them for adoption. It's also a good opportunity if you are looking to adopt and you're not sure if you're ready, it's a trial. So, you know, we have a lot of people that are saying, I'm on the fence, but I really want an animal, but I don't know how it's going to go. Well, we have a program that we do a foster to adopt. So it kind of gives us an opportunity to view an animal in the home and see how they do. And if the adopter decides, well, you know, I just don't know if this is the best time for me, that's totally okay. But it gives us more information about the animal so that we're able to go back out in the community and say, this is what this particular animal needs. So we're always looking for adoptions. We're always looking for building our foster network, especially if you can't commit to a permanent resident in your home again. So volunteer opportunities, we always have volunteer opportunities. You know, we need help walking dogs. We have a very small staff. And it's really vital that we get these animals out there, continue to have them socialized, being around people, being around strangers, being around different situations out in the community, because they're going to be a part of those situations when they are finally adopted. So it's really important that we have animals that are going out in our community that are well-rounded. And that's something that's going to be able to, through volunteering, will really help those animals thrive. You know, whether it's dog walking, we have cat cuddling, you know, just helping feed the animals, or, you know, maybe you just want to help with dishes and laundry, or volunteer at one of our events where we're out in the community spreading outreach and education about what we do. So there's so much that anyone can do if they're, you know, new or looking for something to do, even if it's temporary and it's over the holidays, because maybe someone's out of school for the time being. We do have temporary opportunities as well. So, you know, like I said, there's so many different opportunities for people to get involved. And then certainly lastly, and I like to end it on this, which is just donations. And it can certainly be monetarily if people have the budget to do that. You know, we really pride ourselves on the fact that, you know, people's donations do go a long way at Friends for Animals. We're investing a lot of money into each of these animals to ensure that they get the quality care they deserve. Usually on average, we're spending $900 per animal. Now, mind you, right now we have an adoption special going on where animals are $25. So, you know, we're vaccinating, we're giving rabies vaccines, we're spaying and neutering, we're microchipping, and obviously providing that daily care with feeding and exercise and that sort of thing. So, you know, certainly donations are always helpful. Anyone can go to metrodetroitanimals.org and not only see, you know, ways to donate, but ways to volunteer or foster or get involved. So there's so many different avenues that someone, depending on their, you know, what they're doing and their lifestyle, can get involved. You know, what I would also say is that, you know, another way to directly help the animals is we have wish lists. So, you know, things that we really need, you know, and maybe you want to donate through Amazon or Chewy, you know, whether it's our urgent need list, which is typically prevention, like for heartworm or for flea prevention, to, you know, food, to treats, to Kongs, toys. There's all kind of different things on our wish list that people can order online and just have it directly shipped to our facility.
So many of these different things that you're talking about, I'm sure, can be located on your website as, you know, somebody hears something that's interesting to them and they want to learn more about it. But as I was browsing most recently on the Friends for Animals of Metro Detroit website, which, by the way, is metrodetroitanimals.org, simple as that, I came across the FAMD, or Friends for Animals Metro Detroit Friends Club.
Kind of the way that the Friends Club works is, you know, you just provide a, you know, reoccurring monthly donation. It can be as little as $10 a month. So, you know, basically 2 cups of coffee a month. And you're giving directly to the animals that we're caring for. And kind of what you get in return is a little bit of more of a behind the scenes sneak peek on a monthly basis of the level of work that our staff is doing and the types of animals and the types of stories and care that we see every single day. You know, and it can be certainly anything from, I'm sure there's a lot of people that might have seen, because it did pick up some national news, which was Santana the cat, and he had a crossbow arrow through him. And so we kind of told that story, and our Friends Club gets to see those kind of life-saving moments that, you know, we see, you know, pretty, unfortunately, pretty regularly. And so, you know, so there's a little bit of that in there. Any other sneak peeks that are coming out, or ways that we can give back to that supporter or those members in that club? It always goes to them first. So, you'll get a monthly correspondence. We also have a Friends Club Facebook group that once you're a member, it's a way for just like-minded people to share their stories, their thoughts, and just kind of, like I said, a group of like-minded people just getting together. It's a really exciting, fun little club. Again, keeps people connected if they're really into the animal welfare and the level of work that we do.
My direct connection to animals came at later in my life. I grew up without pets. We also had 9 kids in the family, so not a lot of room for pets in a very small home and 9 children and a mom and dad. But so I had my godmother had a dog and a cat, and she lived far away. But her dog and cat, Blackie and Tinkerbell, she kind of always said were mine. You know, Blackie was my dog and Tinkerbell was my cat. Even though they weren't, you know. So I always, when people say, do you have pets? Oh, yeah, a dog and a cat. Even though I really didn't. And then you're probably too young to remember the very sweet dog movie called Benji. Look it up. Yeah, it's out there. There was some later Benji reboots and things. But the original Benji, and I had a Benji stuffed dog. And I remember putting like a leash, kind of pulling him around the house that Benji was my other pet. I loved them. I just didn't have them around for real. Fast forward 40 years and I meet a special someone who has a special someone. So my husband, whose dog, whose rescue, Mackinac, has now become the love of my life. Both of them, in fact, but we're talking about the dog now. And so starting this sort of fostering this love of animals, oftentimes you think, well, if you love dogs, you've always loved dogs. If you love cats, you've always had them.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone's always kind of yearning for companionship. And, you know, it's something that I always see over and over again. And I've been in animal welfare for almost 20 years. You know, I've seen a lot of these connections and bonds year over year, and you know, really seeing, you know, people really just connect with an animal. And you know, and we all have those in our lives, right? So you know, and whether it's, you know, you start early and you as a kid you grow up and you have pets, and or if you start later like you did, Susan, you end up finding, you know, those connections. And it's all about connection and companionship. And you know, I had a dog named Carl. Make sure that Dave's not around and covers her ears. But Carl was what I would call my heart dog. And so it was the dog that you just connected with. Like, you got each other. You could stare at each other. He got you, you know, and I got him. And, you know, we would, you know, sit on the couch together, watch TV. He sat up like a human, like his little legs hanging over the couch, or you know, he loved people. He loved being around, you know, everyone, and made himself at home. So, you know, my point is it's truly about that connection. And everybody, you know, wants it in one shape, or form. And so, you know, for those that are on the fence, especially because, you know, especially today, it's, you know, everyone's so busy, and, you know, the cost of living and the cost of things are going up, but you still are yearning for that connection in some way. And so for me, you know, a really good option is fostering, because, you know, I've seen a lot of what I'm going to call serial fosters, because that's what they do. They're not committed to one particular animal. They open their home over and over again. And the really great thing about Friends for Animals is the fact that we cover everything. So, you know, when the animal's in foster for that temporary period of time, you know, if you need food, we provide you the food. If you need the crate, we provide you the crate, so that you have everything you need so that the animal could be comfortable while it's staying with you. So, it's such an emotional connection, and we're all emotional beings. And so it's really nice, to see that, and, you know, kind of feel that, you know, yeah. And it's, you know, also sometimes it's nice that they can't always talk back.
So my animal fix when we did those over the years back when I was a student here, in fact, but, the process of connecting in some way sounds like it will be a benefit to Friends for Animals of Metro Detroit, and most importantly, animals. So whether it's whether you can adopt, you know, five big doggies, or, you know, you can just go and spend a Saturday walking some pets or petting some kitties, like you said, it all is going to help out. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we do the other unique thing about Friends for Animals is that we do have a youth program, and not every organization does. And we specifically have a Read to Rover program, which I also thought is really cool. And it's one of the reasons why I signed on to Friends for Animals, because of how innovative we're trying to be. And so, you know, you can be, you know, if you have a child that needs help with reading or feels uncomfortable reading in front of people or their classmates, we have a program that they can sign up for, and they can come in and read to animals. It's therapeutic for the animal. It helps them to be more socialized, and it also helps the child, you know, really be able to feel no judgment while they, you know, read through a book or try to pronunciate certain words. So I love the program. I love seeing, you know, kids be dropped off by their parents and kids just, you know, kneeling or sitting next to a cat or a dog reading to them. And a lot of times it's really fun to see those dogs or cats listening. Like they're legitimately listening. They're laying there and you could see the ease and the stress just go away.
That's just absolutely amazing. Corey, how long have you been with Friends for Animals of Metro Detroit at this point?
So I started in March of this year. So I'm relatively new. I'm coming off of about 8 to 9 months now. And so, you know, it's been a really fun, exciting time. Like I said, I really love this organization with all my heart and passion. And so we have so much more to do, and there's so much more work ahead of us. But it's been a really great time. It's a really great organization to get involved with.
Amazing. I knew you were new. I didn't know you were that new. So yay. We're so glad to have you here in our community. And when we talk about Metro Detroit versus Dearborn, we know that this shelter does certainly, it located in Dearborn, and Dearborn residents, as I understand, continue to support it, but it's not just, you know, it's not just this little corner of the world. It also is truly Metro Detroit as well. So some of the events that you sort of inherited, I'm sure, things that the organization has done, like the Black Tie and Tails and the Mutt Strut and so on, those do really attract people from all over. So are you seeing that we are getting, are you hitting the people that you need to sort of in those outer areas versus just this sort of more core central community? And how's that going these days?
Yeah, I mean, just as you said, Susan, you know, we are servicing, you know, obviously we're in Dearborn, but we're also Metro Detroit. And so, you know, certainly, you know, it's very important to the organization that we are serving our communities and most certainly Dearborn, because we are located in Dearborn. But we do service, you know, areas, cities and counties outside in the Metro Detroit area, because we do have programs all over that will support people in need too. You know, again, whether it's volunteering, service groups, things of that nature, we have a Feed Fido program for those residents in the Metro Detroit area that can't afford pet food right now, but they want to keep their pet. And so, you know, we also have partnered with other organizations outside of Dearborn to provide low-cost vaccine clinics through grants. We're doing a lot of other things in the community. I only foresee us getting more involved in the Metro Detroit area. We do have some PetSmart adoption locations as well, where we have some cats that are in those PetSmart locations, or we will hold adoption events at those locations. Those are outside of Dearborn. We certainly want to expand and get the word out there about what we're doing, because we're doing so much. It's also one of the reasons why we had to, you know, like I mentioned, we built our education and adoption center in 2018, and we did groundbreaking this year to expand it. But we're not done. We still have an additional phase that we need to do. And that's all stems from the fact and the need in the community. There's a demand in the community to provide more programs and services, not just for Dearborn, but again, that Metro Detroit area. And for us to do that, we had to expand our facility to be able to accommodate. So, you know, I certainly see us getting a little bit more out there in those other communities, but we still have a lot of work to do.
One of the things that I think that is so fascinating about this organization is how well organized it is. And I will give you some credit because you've been here long enough to have earned some credit. But we also know that you're sort of stepping into some sort of a legacy of really well-run stuff. And I speak to the website directly because it is just so easy to follow. It's so interactive. And there's just so much information on here. As I'm looking, again, MetroDetroitAnimals.org. Even something as simple as a resources page that offers different things for new pet owners that are maybe in new situations, things related to tips and tricks and so on. There is just really so much to be had by way of just general information here that I sort of can't push it enough here. So tell us a little bit about resources, and then I just want to, we just have a little more time, I want to wrap up by talking about maybe the do's and don'ts of giving somebody a pet for Christmas.
Again, one of the unique things is the fact that Friends for Animals has a lot of resources on our website. It's really important for the organization that we are all informed and educated, and we're always constantly learning. And I think, you know, as a little teaser, I think you're going to see more of that in 2024. But we do have a lot of good resources up there, and it's, you know, everything again from tips and tricks on things with your newly adopted pet, but also, you know, resources, you know, in case, you know, you're not sure about something that might come up and you're not necessarily an experienced pet owner. And you have questions, but most importantly, is the fact that our staff and volunteers are pretty accessible. So, you know, even if you go on our website and you are looking at our resource and saying, this is all great material. However, it doesn't really, like, I feel like I fall in a different area and I don't know what to do. Our staff are really knowledgeable, and we have a lot of seasoned staff that have been in animal welfare for a pretty long time. And we're able to certainly help navigate you through whatever situation you're going through with the animal. You know, again, maybe it's something like a behavior that has developed and you're not sure how to handle it or who to go to. And a lot of times we might refer you to, you know, maybe it's, you know, obedience training that the dog needs or, that sort of thing. And so we'll provide resources, referrals, anything that really help you. And, you know, we love just to have that conversation because, you know, as I said in the beginning of this interview, it's not just about adopting animals. We're there all along the way, especially this year too. And I've been seeing a lot of this online and, you know, talking internally with a lot of my colleagues in animal welfare. And we've been talking about this for, you know, a long time. And it's always about giving pets as gifts. And it doesn't necessarily have to be around the holidays. You know, sometimes, you know, people are like, oh, I want to give, you know, my grandmother a kitten for her birthday or something along those lines. And so the biggest thing that I would always say and the biggest piece of advice that I think any colleague of mine would say is, it's always about thinking it through and having a conversation and also being transparent, honest with whatever shelter or rescue or humane society you're working with. You know, there's actually some studies that are out there. One of them you can find through ASPCA. They did a 10-year study on this, and it was statistically proven that we do not see any more increase in returns if pets are given as gifts. So it's been disproven. And, you know, I've had a couple of interviews regarding something very similar to this. And I will always say, you know, statistically, anytime you have any sort of large event, maybe it's a big adopt-a-thon or you do a big fee-waived adoption event, statistically, you're going to see more animals adopted, but also statistically, you're also going to probably see more animals returned. It's just the balance of things. And that could be around the holidays. That could be, like I said, a big adopt-a-thon maybe in July that you decide to do because you're over capacity with litters of kittens. But it really doesn't change the fact that it's always about the conversation and just being very diligent and open and honest about what you're doing. You know, maybe it is for your child, but let's talk it through. Does this make sense? Do you have the resources? Do you have the support system to be able to bring this animal home during the holidays? You know, like I said, I refer back to this ASPCA article because they said, you know, even though the animal was a gift, they didn't love the animal any less, right? And I believe 80% of the animals that were given as gifts remained in the home and stayed in that home for the rest of its life. So, you know, certainly it's been disproven that we would see an increase in returns after the holiday season. Specifically, a lot of people will say, well, won't you see returns in January? It's not the case. It's all about counseling. And that's what you'll see. I think a lot of animal welfare organizations have shifted to. It's about counseling, building trust with the potential adopter, that there's no judgment, that we can talk through things to make sure it's the right environment for you and for the animal, because we want it to be successful. So, I mean, it's never a good idea to just spring something on anyone, regardless if it's a pet or not. But you also have to understand, well, you know, does your grandmother want a pet at this time? Has she been talking about it? Has your uncle been talking about it? Or, you know, getting more indicators out there and explaining that to those shelters or rescues, the more transparent and honest, the easier it's going to be to really try to help and guide that potential adopter for what either their home's looking for, or, you know, even, you know, their family members looking for. And if you're on the fence or not sure, what I would always recommend is, okay, you know, then why don't you do this? Why don't you surprise your family member by bringing them to the shelter and say, hey, we want to sponsor an adoption fee for Christmas for you. You know, why don't you look around and find the animal that you really connect with? We've had that happen a couple of times where, you know, parents have brought their child in and blindfolded them, and put even headphones on so they didn't know what was going on, and then surprised them and put them in the cat room or the dog area. And those are really amazing, and emotional things, you know, situations that we get to see. My point is that, you know, people actually taking the time and being diligent about the approach of how we're going to give the animal as a gift versus just kind of, you know, going to shelter saying, well, I want this particular animal and I'm going to be giving it to my uncle. Well, let's have a conversation about that first and what that looks like.
That's just great advice. And I'm really pleased to hear about the study that you talked about in terms of the statistics of gift giving, you know, gift giving the pet and so on. And really what you're speaking to, I think Corey talks about that mindset that I've heard. And I kind of believe these days, so many people that have adopted from shelters have said this, you kind of don't pick the animal sort of picks you. Do you get to see those love connections in your time at when you're at the facility, and how heartwarming must that be? Huh?
All the time. Yeah, it's really inspiring to see those connections when they just click like that. Or, you know, even the scenarios where, you know, people see these really, you know, obviously heartwarming stories or these animals that come out of really disparaging situations, or, you know, sort of my heart always goes to senior animals, because maybe their owner passed away or something happened in that owner's life where they just can't financially afford the animal anymore. And you see them, you know, we had one dog named Arthur who was he was vision impaired. We think he had also had he might have been deaf or some sort of issue there. Older, like lab mix, maybe 10 years old. was at the shelter for a while, and, you know, a gentleman in New York just saw him online and said, "That's my dog," and drove, you know, cross state lines to come and adopt him. And it was such a great connection. So, you know, we get to see that on a pretty regular basis, and it's life changing. So, you know, it's really nice to see that, you know, people are out there that, you know, or like I said, creating that emotional connection, that companionship, but really kind of going out of their way sometimes to say, you know, this guy just needs a second chance, give him a break, you know? And, you know, this young gentleman from New York just happened to see him, I think, you know, via social media one day because we were spotlighting him, and just drove cross state lines. So it was an amazing story.
Heartwarming. You're making me choked up here, I'll tell you. I'll blame the congestion, but yeah, that was all that story right there. Well, Corey, this has just been fascinating, and we absolutely are so happy to have had the time to spend with you today on our journal show. Thank you for the extra time. We went longer than I said I would need you for, but I so appreciate that. And absolutely, I feel like we've just scratched the surface, so I want to totally have you come back and talk about some of the other facets, because this just truly isn't enough time to get into all of the different things that you're doing, you and your team, as well as the brilliant team of supporters and volunteers with Friends for Animals of Metro Detroit. I mean, looking on the resources page here, wildlife tips. I didn't even get in, you know, we didn't even think about that. DIY pet toys, you know, things, what to do with your pet should you happen to be positive for COVID. You know, there's so many things we could talk about, but I know time is limited, so we'll wrap this one up. But congratulations on being off to just an amazing start with your new role here in your capacity as president and CEO. And we're glad to have had this first time of you joining us on WHFR, first of many to come, I hope. We wish you all just the best of this holiday season. We know with the work that you and your team are doing, we're making some great progress. So really appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
We've got more on the way. This is the WHFR Journal. Please do stay with us.
Over 60 and retired? Making ends meet, especially at the supermarket, is tough. BenefitsCheckup.org is a free website that helps you pay for food, medicine, even utilities. Visit BenefitsCheckup.org.
In our next discussion, we hope to shine some light on resources and opportunities available that are literally in our own backyard here in the Dearborn community. So we're going to welcome to our line Dave Sirio, who is curator of education and also curator of the Arab Film Festival at the one and only Arab American National Museum. We are truly fortunate to have this gem in our community, literally a stone's throw away. And it surprises me how many people, when I talk about opportunities that are available through this organization, just don't get the breadth and the depth of what is housed in this venue and what is available via resources at the museum. So we thought we'd spend a little time today introducing you to it if you're a first timer. And if you haven't been in a while, we're going to welcome you back. And there's an exciting film series we're going to talk about that literally just started yesterday, and so much more. But I can't think of a more important time to share opportunities for education than at this time of what we're going through as a world. So Dave Sirio, welcome to the Journal. We're really happy to have you here today.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for inviting me. It's good to be here.
Thank you. So the titles that I shared, Education and the Film Fest, all sounds like it involves your sort of bridging what you've got at the museum to this community. Tell us a little bit about how you see your role and exactly what you do. Mm-hmm.
Sure, absolutely. So yeah, you hit it right on the nose. Like, the Arab American National Museum is, we also agree that it's kind of like a jewel in the community. It's something that is, you know, it's the only museum of its kind in the entire country. So we're very fortunate to have such a unique institution in our backyard that helps to fill the gap of the kind of the missing stories that we see here, right? You don't often see, if you go through like curriculum in schools, you might see like a dot that represents the Arab American community in like subjects that are being taught, but we don't see the really essential stories that we tell in those classrooms. So we're kind of there to help insert the Arab American narrative and story into that larger fabric That is, so like you said, is very important to be discussing along with other community stories as well. We opened our doors May 5th, 2005. So we're just over 18 years old. We're coming up to our 19th year anniversary. And we're also a Smithsonian affiliated institution and also accredited by the American Alliance of Museums, which are two really big badges of honor that a lot of museums strive for, especially that accreditation status. And to have that and Smithsonian status, affiliate status, I think before we hit our 10-year anniversary, I think speaks real volumes as to the work that we do. And to kind of go back to what you were saying, the museum is a really rich treasure trove when it comes to the educational materials that we have and also our public programming. And we do a lot at the museum, but my role specifically is within education, doing tours, presentations, welcoming people in to gain knowledge about the Arab American community for non-Arab and for Arab Americans. We think our community knows our whole story. And while we may know quite a bit, we don't know the full story, right? We don't know that Arabic speaking folks have been coming to North America 500 years ago. We don't know. So there's lots of pieces of the story that even us Arab Americans don't know. So we're really, again, a very essential institution to tell those stories through education, but then also through public programs. So I do a very small segment of our public programs, but our public programming team does a really essential job, an excellent job as to highlighting those stories through art, through film, through performance, through, our artist in residence program. So there's a lot happening at the museum. That's just kind of a snippet of as to what we do.
Oh, no doubt it is a snippet, but thank you for sharing that. In regards to the film fest, it is something that I think almost more people relate to, connect with the film fest, because it is just huge and prolific and amazing, than maybe even attending the museum itself, which is, it speaks to the complementary nature of those two things being available and being accessible sort of cohesively. But you talk about education and we talk about the history books and so on. Our youth in the community, our children, our second, third, fourth, multiple generations of not only, again, Arab students and children, but non-Arabs as well. How big is the presence of opportunities for the young people to learn the realities as well as, facts versus mis or disinformation that they may be getting from other media outlets, et cetera?
Sure. No, that's a great question. So I think one of the great things that we do, and this is more for like teachers who might be engaging with this this program, is we do a lot of like field trips. We do a lot of guided tours and field trips for K-12 groups that come to the museum. And a lot of the groups do like a half day workshop. So it's not just like a tour and then you leave. it'll be like a guided tour. There'll be some craft activities that are really engaging and fun that relate to like Arab art. We'll teach a little bit of like traditional Arabic dance, which is always a fun thing to learn. And then we also have provide like lunch for students as well. So kids, when they come, they're really getting like a nice even picture as to like learning about the community, right? So from like the exhibits and more of a very like very traditional educational lens, but through arts and craft, through dance, through food. And honestly, like arts and food is some of the easiest ways to learn about a culture. And so we really try to give folks like a nice half day when they come here versus just kind of shuttling them in, tour, and then out. We try to like spend time with them and give them various aspects of the community so that they can learn more about the community through various means. And then in addition to that, we also provide like scavenger hunts. So sometimes if folks want to come on their own or with their families, we'll provide like little scavenger hunts for families to do together, sometimes with a little scavenger hunt prize at like special programs. So folks can come in on their own, look through the exhibits, have a little scavenger hunt, do it together as a family. And then we do a lot of like family friendly events as well. So we have like sometimes, probably our most popular events are our family programming, our family events. So we typically do two big family events throughout the year. We do one around this time, around the holidays, and then we also do one during Eid. And so during those times, we open the museum up. It's free admission. There's a scavenger hunt. There are a bunch of like hands-on crafts for kids. There's usually like an edible craft, a cookie decorating craft, which is always fun and very messy. We do story time in the library. We do bilingual Arabic English story time as part of the family events, but then also kind of a standalone program occasionally, where we'll have somebody reading a story in Arabic and then in English. We see the need for our community to like want to like pass down language skills to their kids. So we provide like a bilingual story time, again, separately, but also as part of these family events. We have like a vendor market as well. So getting like local entrepreneurs to come in and like sell their goods that the community can engage with. And so those are, I think, just without rambling on too much, those are a couple of really good examples, I think, is how the museum engages families. And I guess the last thing I'll add to from more of our curatorial team is the collection of different objects as well. So we're always collecting objects, oral histories. We have a really robust oral history program where we'll bring people in to record their oral histories. And that's been something that we do sometimes with families, sometimes one-on-one with adults. And then we also collect objects and we use those objects sometimes to put in the exhibits or to do like object-based learning where kids can come in and like feel these different objects that were brought over to the U.S. 150 years ago or were brought over yesterday. And there are things that kids, they get really excited when they recognize the object. They're like, oh, my gosh, like we have this in our home. So that's also another way that we connect with the community to like donate their stories and their objects. And then we also use those as teachable moments for groups.
Wow, this is the time when I want to, since my little one is 24 and 6'5", I would want to borrow like the neighbor's little one and bring them to the museum to enjoy all of those youth and family opportunities, particularly that cookie decorating thing sounds pretty good. But it really sounds like you're sort of meeting people through means that will allow information to settle and, you know, and be digested, if you will, versus just that sort of stringent, look at this body of work. Now let's discuss, you know. So the opportunity to really educate, as you have indicated, and as educators we like to believe, is through multiple means and getting, you know, connecting with people, because even every child, of course, is going to learn differently, et cetera. So, and it also sounds like maybe starting opportunities or planting seeds to create some further dialogue between parents and children, or, you know, children and children and family members once they leave the project or once they're done with the scavenger hunt, et cetera. Do you get, once somebody comes in, Dave, do you get repeaters? I would suspect you would, or they experience it with the school group at one point and then kind of come back with other family members.
That's the hope, right? The hope is that we get folks that come for a program, and we've had that quite a bit of times. We'll have folks that have come as part of like a school field trip, and then they'll come back for the family programs, or they'll come back for a film, or they'll come back for like, a different event that's happening. So our goal really is to like continuously try to engage these community members, to come to, you know, one event and then ideally come back for future events. And ideally, hopefully for, not just Arab Americans, of course, but really everybody in our community to see us as, an essential institution, an essential storyteller, that people will be like, oh, like I need to be a part of this really great organization and, you know, come to programming, partake in like the youth activities that we offer. We have a lot of other youth programs, which I won't ramble about necessarily, but we have like our youth photography program, which has been running longer than the museum has been around. It started off at Access, which is our parent organization, and then we adopted it as the museum came about. So there's that. There's other youth programming. We're working with the Smithsonian on a couple of like STEM-related activities for high school students. So there's a lot happening. So again, yeah, our goal is really that once folks engage with us, they'll find other avenues to connect, to be a part of a program, to donate an object or an oral history, to take their future generations to the museum, to volunteer with the museum. So there's lots of really great ways for folks to get involved. And then I think one thing that we're doing too is like, if we're not meeting those needs, like we're not, we're pretty self-aware, I think, or I'd like to think. And so we have started doing listening sessions, community conversations to figure out exactly is the museum meeting the needs of those community members? Are they coming back time and again? Are these kids excited to engage with us? And if they're not, what are we missing? What can we do better? So that's really one of our focuses, is to continuously get folks into our door to see us as this really essential institution. And if we're not meeting that, how can we do that? How can we engage those folks and bring them into the museum fold and provide for them? What do they need versus just come to our programs and then that's it.
Mm-hmm. So it's really, it's not one-sided, I guess I'll put it that way. That's fantastic. The galleries are gorgeous. The facility is stunning and colorful and beautiful. So if you haven't been, you really need to take some time at the Arab American National Museum, whether it's just to wander or to shop or to participate in a program actively. That's my testimonial. Dave, this is, it's a difficult time that we are seeing these beautiful communities in the spotlight, in the news. And one can only hope that when there are questions or concerns about just everything that's going on these days, that we're sort of looking to inform ourselves and to, to turn this into something that can be educational and hopefully rational and peace-filled. What's different now with the museum? How are you sort of positioning or addressing the conflict, the huge conflict that's going on internationally? Have you taken steps to make some tweaks and so on? And what's the protocol there?
Sure. The museum, as a obviously an apolitical, a religious, or neutral organization, we of course have to remain politically neutral and whatnot. I think we, in times where our community needs us, we double down on what we do really best, right? So we have stories from folks all across the Arab world, including in Palestine, these stories that we uplift, right? And we do them regardless of if something is happening on an international level or not. But we highlight those stories. And so we have a really great story of Ahmed Ibrahim, who comes over from Palestine and is forcibly removed from his land. And we tell that story in general. But I think now, because of what's going on, people, I don't want to say relate more to it, but there's a deeper connection that they can physically see as we see everything unfolding on social media. And so those stories are always impactful, but they can be more impactful because folks who are not connected to what's going on see what's going on, and then they can hear Ahmed's story that happened, 75 years ago or something like that. And they can still see the connection to what's going on today. So we really, when these things happen, we really uplift stories that we have in our exhibitions. We highlight the objects that we've collected. For example, we have a lot of Palestinian keys that people have graciously donated to us. And we talk about, why would somebody bring, with school groups, why would you bring an old key with you? And we have those conversations of like, here's why people are bringing these keys with them. Or Ahmed, the exhibit that I was just referring to, has one of the things he has is a medicine bottle full of dirt. And so for a lot of kids, they're like, well, why would you bring dirt with you? That's a weird thing. It's like, that's a great question. Why would you bring dirt with you? Let's unpack that. Let's talk about that, right? So in normal times, we talk about that. But I think we try to elevate some of those stories when the community in general, regardless of where you're from or where you're at, has those types of questions. We really try to amplify those stories. And I think the other thing that we do too is we create programming to help educate folks on what's going on, or just really, again, to help uplift those narratives. So we have some film programming that's taking place. We have in November and also in December. In November, and I think it's still going on through the month of December as well now, we've partnered with the Arab Film and Media Institute out in California and Arte East, which is an organization in New York, to do a film series called Palestinian Voices. And it's all Palestinian narratives based on the lives of Palestinians, whether it's folks in Gaza, in the West Bank, across the world, the diaspora, but really uplifting these, using these films as a way to uplift these voices, right? And then the series that just launched again with Arab Film and Media Institute and Arte East, that just launched, I believe, yesterday, is a series called Freedom in Frame: Stories of Nonviolent Resistance. And it is a series of short films. Four films. I think one is short and the rest are like more feature length. And they're all films, again, that highlight Palestine, Palestinians, the Palestinian diaspora. And we're also partnering with Just Vision as well. Just Vision graciously is allowing us to screen four of their films. And so the series is kind of a partnership between Just Vision and then the other institutions, including our museum. And we find that, again, in times of conflict, in times of where we see some really unfortunate, devastating things happening to the community, that education is really, really key to dispelling those stereotypes and allowing, in the cases of the stories and the film programming that we're doing, allowing Palestinians' voices to be heard versus using some textbook that was written by some American person who happened to visit the area, which is not a bad perspective, but really centering Palestinian voices during this time. And we see this with other things too. We've done this with Yemen too. We just recently did, my days are confused. Last Friday, we did a really excellent film series with a partnership with El Yemenia, which I think is based in the UK overseas. And they curated a short film series of Yemeni voices, right? And we highlighted and showcased those films to tell the story of what's going on in Yemen, both the devastation happening in Yemen, but also some of the light, fun things that Yemenis are doing again across the world. So we saw like some snippets, moments in time, some really beautiful films made. And so again, we use these films with, again, Arab Americans and Arab diaspora that really help to kind of elevate these voices and perspectives, regardless of what's going on.
Where can we find these films?
So you can find information about the film series that just launched yesterday on the Arab American National Museum's website. If you go to arabamericanmuseum.org, you'll find the film program, the Arab film series online, Freedom in Frames, on our website. And then if you want to check out the Palestinian Voices program that I had mentioned, is also a joint partnership between the Arab Film and Media Institute and Arte East that was in November and continuing until the end of this year. You can go to the Arab Film and Media Institute's website at arabfilminstitute.org/Palestinian Voices, and you'll be able to see all the really rich films that that are a part of that showcase as well.
Dave, thank you for this wealth of information. I wish we had more time to continue going through every different aspect of what this museum has to offer. We didn't even get into the shopping part, but I do want to make sure that we get into the donating or joining as a member. You've got an online newsletter, as I understand. How can people connect more directly so that they can get this information about events and screenings and so on to then potentially support this wonderful museum?
Absolutely. So yeah, please, if folks are interested in joining and seeing what the museum has to offer, you can, again, go to the museum's website, again, arabamericanmuseum.org. There is, at the bottom of our homepage, you'll see like a digital newsletter. You can click sign up, throw your email address in there, and you'll receive the different emails that go out about different events. You can also email me as well if you're having trouble. You can email me, and I know, Susan, you have my email address. Folks can reach out to me directly if they have any questions, or if they're like, listen, I only want to be a part of like film stuff, or I only want to be a part of, you know, this, that, or the other. We can make sure that you're not getting everything, although you should get everything because we do a lot of really cool stuff. But if you have a preference, you can always email me and I can kind of like make sure that I put you on a specific list. But the general list is always, I think, useful because you get a nice smattering of like everything that's going on. You'll get monthly updates on all the events happening for that month. So that's a really good way to stay updated to the museum. And then also on that homepage, you'll find ways to join as well. There's a link to become a member of the museum. Memberships are really where you're staying connected to the museum and everything happening. You get special perks for being a member of the museum. And it's also a very reasonable cost, in my humble opinion. It's a very reasonable cost. I think it's about $45 a year to be a member. There's discounts for seniors. There's some higher level memberships that allow you more access to more things. So there's a lot of different offerings there. And then you'll also find a link to become a volunteer. That's another great way to stay connected to the museum and give back to your community and volunteer with us. There's general donation information under our Join and Give tab. So lots of ways to stay connected to the museum. And again, happy to help folks navigate that.
Thank you. I will go ahead and just toss your email address out there right now, Dave. DSERIO@accesscommunity.org. Again, DSERIO@accesscommunity.org. Dave, this has been a pleasure again. Please, will you come back in the new year so we can pick up where we left off today and then highlight some other things that I know are on the horizon here with the museum?
Absolutely. Would love to. January starts the kickoff of, well, for most people, the new year. And so we have a lot of events coming up once January comes. So would love to come back and discuss some of the really exciting things we're doing.
Thank you. Thank you. We hope the next time we have the chance to chat, it will be under better world circumstances as well. Wishing you, the entire staff and community at the Arab American National Museum, all the best and just continued energy to keep up all of this effort that you're putting forth for people to learn and educate themselves about this culture, this rich and beautiful culture. And all the best to you as well, Dave. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you. Same to you.
This is the WHFR Journal. Hope you have enjoyed this session. I know I have. We do have more on the way right here on 89.3 FM. Please stay with us.
Hi, this is Missy J, host of The House That Jack Swing Built. I want to take time out to wish each and every one of you a very blessed holiday season. Also, thank you for listening to the station that makes waves while branching farther out into the community. WHFR 89.3.fm on your dial.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio featuring local and independent artists.
There's a place you can find classic blues and R&B that's seldom heard on the radio. Hi, I'm Anderson Coleman, inviting you to listen to the station Making Waves and enjoy Blues with a Feeling. I'm here on WHFR.FM Saturdays from 8 to 10 p.m. Come and keep it locked on 89.3 FM Dearborn.